Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link, live from Bonn in Germany. I am Abubakar Jallo. In the next 25 minutes, the Nigerian government says it will negotiate with rebel groups in the Niger, oil-rich Niger Delta region.
There are a lot of frantic efforts from every person, from communities communities in the Niger Delta, even amongst those of us who call ourselves elders here. There are all sort of conversations going on because every person knows the consequences of an implosion in the Niger Delta.
And Uganda accuses opposition parties of planning to topple the government of President Yoweri Museveni, claims this opposition politician denies.
Power relations in Africa is such that once you're in government, because you don't want to leave government, and that is historical, you are actually an enemy, so they want to extinguish you for them to feel comfortable that now they are in full control.
And here in Bonn, Deutsche Welle's annual Global Media Forum has gotten underway to address current issues affecting the media in the rest of the world. And we shall be talking to one of the participants from Uganda, so stay tuned.
Top story.
The Nigerian government is again attempting to reach out to rebel groups in the troubled and oil-rich Niger Delta region to hold talks over issues that sparked the rebellion. In a short moment, we will bring you a background report about the reason for the conflict, but for now, let's find out what's currently happening on the ground. Traditional monarchs in the region have joined efforts for some peace negotiations, but a faction of the rebels, the deadly Niger Delta Avengers, responsible for most of the recent attacks on oil facilities, say they will not negotiate with the government. From the regional capital, Port Harcourt, Mohammed Bello filed this report.
For some days now, the federal government of Nigeria has been trying to reach out to various stakeholders in the oil region, including some of the militant groups that have been destroying oil facilities lately. Some of the militant groups, including the Niger Delta Liberation Force, Joint Revolutionary Council of Niger Delta, and the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta MEND, have said they are prepared to enter into dialogue with the government. However, on Sunday, the Niger Delta Avengers was still maintaining no negotiation stance, though it has refrained from bombing more installations. MEND, a renowned militant group in the region, in a statement by its spokesperson Jomo Bomo, said it has constituted a team of patriotic and selfless men and women of proven track record drawn from different parties of the Niger Delta who are to dialogue with the federal government on the immediate, medium and long-term future of the Niger Delta. Mr. Ledumiti is one of the members recommended by MEN in its planned dialogue with the government.
I don't know whether any negotiation has started, but I also heard that my name has been mentioned. And I'm happy to participate if there is a genuine dialogue that is initiated.
Mr. Mite, however, confirmed that currently there are efforts being made in the region to arrive at a solution to the present crisis.
There are a lot of frantic efforts from every person, from communities in the Niger Delta, even amongst those of us who call ourselves elders here. There are all sort of conversations going on because every person knows the consequences of an implosion in the Niger Delta, not only to the economy of the country, but also to even the people that live in this area. No one wants to see a full-drawn military invasion of this part of the country. It does not portend very good to people who live here. So I have very strong hope that somehow we'll reach some pathway.
The refusal of the Niger Delta Avengers to avoid any form of negotiation could be one reason why the leadership of the Nigerian army has its renewed commitment to tackle militancy in the region. On this, Mr. Roberts Wilson, a youth in the oil region, advised government to toe the line of dialogue.
Situations like this, you don't just take it headlong like that. I see a need, call these boys to order and find out what is their reason for doing what they're doing. And at the end of it, after listening to them, you go back to your drawing board and see to how you can actually meet up their needs, because there is no smoke without fire. So it's good for government to dialogue with them.
Some of the militant groups in the region have issued the government with a number of demands that they say have to be met if peace is to prevail. They include restructuring of the amnesty program with upward review of funding to accommodate more beneficiaries.
Mohammed Bello in Port Harcourt. The Niger Delta has a long and troubled history of conflict over oil. But how did it all begin? And who started it? Fred Muvunyi and Loveday Wright have the answers in this fact box.
Ogoniland lies in the southeast of the Niger Delta Basin. Economically viable oil deposits were first discovered there in 1957.
The Ogoni people are a minority ethnic group of about 500,000 who call Ogoniland their home.
The Ogonis and other groups in the region say that the government began forcing them to abandon their land to oil companies without consultation or proper compensation shortly after the deposits were discovered.
In the 1970s and 1980s, the Ogoni's dissatisfaction increased. Environmental, social and economic conditions worsened after the government failed to provide the assistance it had promised.
The conflict over tensions between foreign oil corporations and a number of the Niger Delta's minority ethnic groups heightened in the 1990s. Particularly the Ogoni and the Ijaw felt they were being exploited.
Ethnic and political unrest continued throughout the decade despite Nigeria's conversion from military rule to democracy and the election of the Obasanjo civilian government in 1999.
Competition for oil wealth fueled violence between many ethnic groups, causing the militarization of nearly the entire region by ethnic militia groups as well as by Nigerian military and police forces. In 2003 and 2004, local and state officials offered financial support to those paramilitary groups they believed would assist with the promotion of their own political agenda.
Meanwhile, the oil industry was being targeted by acts of piracy and kidnappings. However, in 2009, the then Nigerian President Umaru Musa Yar'Adua granted the oil militants an amnesty program. Those who renounced violence were offered financial assistance and job training. The program has been described as a success.
Recently, President Muhammadu Buhari announced he was going to wind down the program by 2018. This could have contributed to the re-emergence of oil militancy.
Fred Muvunyi and Loveday Wright. And still to come, the United Nations urges Kenya to extend the November deadline for the closure of the world's largest refugee camp, Dadaab.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
The Ugandan police have on Monday called an attack on one of its stations as an attempt by rebel groups loyal to opposition parties to overthrow the government of President Yoweri Museveni. This statement came a day after unknown gunmen assaulted a police station in the northern district of Gulu, killing one policeman and injuring several officers, including civilians. Museveni's four-time challenger Kizza Besigye is detained at a maximum security prison in the capital Kampala. As Alex Chita reports, the army has been deployed into Gulu.
The Uganda police chief, Major General Kale Kaihura, says the attackers wanted to rescue one of their colleagues, Dan Ola Odia. Odia was arrested last week and is held at Gulu Central Police Station on treason charges. Kaihura particularly pointed out that the suspects are part of a new rebel group loyal to former presidential candidate Kizza Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC.
The gang was repulsed by a joint police UPDF force, which had been deployed earlier to reinforce the security of the station following information that there was probability of an armed attack on the station. The objective of the attack was to free and cause escape of one suspect called Ola Dan Odia, who is due to appear in court on charges of murder and terrorism.
Whereas the police chief seemed certain of the attackers, the district police commander, Gulu Moses Okoyo, told journalists that they were still investigating the matter in order to ascertain those behind the attack. Odia, who the police claim the attackers wanted to rescue, is the deputy secretary for mobilization for the opposition party, Uganda People's Congress, UPC. He was arrested on Wednesday last week, the same day a member of parliament in Kampala, Michael Kabaziguruka, was also detained on treason charges. UPC officials have rubbished these claims. But Kaihura insists that they have evidence that links Odia to other rebel activities.
There is strong evidence against this Ola Dan Odia, linking him to an earlier armed attack, which we believe was by the same gang, on a local defense unit detachment.
It is not the first time members of the opposition have been linked to rebel activities in Uganda. Kizza Besigye himself was charged with treason in 2011 for having links with the Rebel People's Redemption Army before the court acquitted him. The spokesperson for the Forum for Democratic Change, Ibrahim Samjunganda, says government is trying to fail political parties by linking them to rebel activities.
Power relations in Africa is such that once you're in government, because you don't want to leave government, and that is historical, you are actually an enemy, so they want to extinguish you for them to feel comfortable that now they are in full control.
When gunfire opened at 8 p.m. in Gulu, businesses were abandoned as residents ran to safety. They only returned in the morning following assurances from the army that the town was safe. The spokesperson of the Uganda Army, Paddy Ankunda, took to Twitter as the attacks went on to say that this was a rescue mission for Odia. This attack has awakened memories of unrest in the area that went through a civil war for close to 2 decades as the Lodi's Resistance Army rebel outfit tried to overthrow Museveni's government. The army and the police have in the meantime put all their barracks on high alert, saying they are all likely targets.
Alex Chita in Kampala, and you're listening to DW's Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo. Still to come in this program, how a young man in Cameroon used his experience to help young teenagers out of crime and violence. But up next, DW's Global Media Forum.
Africa on the move.
Now, for 9 years, Deutsche Welle has been hosting the Global Media Forum. The forum brings together over 2,000 experts from all over the world in the fields of journalism, digital media, and politics. It addresses the role of media in politics and also civil society. And here at Africa Link, we dedicated this segment, Africa on the Move, to this forum. One of the participants is Peter Mwesige, who is the executive director of the Africa Center for Media Excellence in Uganda. And my colleague, Jenaiko Kumet, brought him into our studios to discuss the struggle for media freedom in his country.
Uganda is kind of, a duality of sorts. On the one hand, if you're a visitor to Uganda, any day, any time of the year, for the most part, you would be amazed by the dynamism in the media, the vibrancy of the media industry. Vibrant talk shows, newspapers with screaming and sensational headlines. Television stories that are very critical of the establishment. So, on the face of it, in one sense, it appears the media are free. On the other hand, there's lots of self-censorship within newsrooms, especially, in the countryside. So I would say that it is a mixed bag by and large.
Sounds interesting. It's a mixed bag by and large.
Yeah.
We are living in an era of vibrant social media.
Mm.
I'd like to hear from you. Are social media offering new opportunities for democratization in your Africa and in your country and perhaps in Africa at large?
Definitely, there is everything to be excited about social media. But I also want to believe that we must be cautious in the way we celebrate the advent of social media in Africa, because I do not think that their proliferation and reach is at a level where we can talk about the vast population having access and being able to be influenced or to influence others on social media. I think that in our context, we still want to recognize the complementarity of social media and mainstream media. In other words, social media still have to work hand in hand with with mainstream media in order for us to see the benefits of free information and access to information. And I'm saying this because, as you know, there are still only thousands or hundreds of thousands of Ugandans who have access to the internet. A majority of Ugandans still don't have access to the internet, and therefore they don't have access to social media like Twitter, like Facebook, although a good number have access to WhatsApp. So that kind of limits who is heard and when they are heard.
Now, President Museveni has for over time now been seen as somebody who tries to rather suppress or silence the media. What do you have to say about this?
The story of Museveni and the media, it's like a love-hate story over the years. I mean, on the one hand, Museveni was very encouraging, I think, in his early years of a free press, in a sense, because having banned independent media, having banned, political parties, he thought, sort of felt like the media were, his way of showing the whole world that Uganda was a free country. He could always say, we have talk shows, I can be abused on radio, the newspapers can draw cartoons of me and all that. With the advent of multi-party politics about 10 years ago, we seem to be seeing a different story, altogether, because it appears that the media have come under far more attack under Museveni's Uganda, under the multi-party regime, than they were under, the so-called movement system. And I think that because of the tendency for the media to give a platform to opposition political parties, they are now treated more like enemies than ever before.
Ugandan journalist and activist Peter Mwesige. Now, Kenya plans to close the world's largest refugee camp, Dadaab, later this year. But the United Nations says the process should not result in people being forcibly returned to war-torn Somalia. This message was conveyed by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Felipe Grande, as he concluded his five-day visit to Kenya and Somalia. Kenya has vowed to send back 350,000 Somali refugees living in camps located northeast of the country. It cited security reasons, arguing that the camp has become a ground for terrorist training. Rube Kiama report.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Mr. Filippo Grandi, has appealed to the Kenyan government to extend the time frame for closing down Dadaab, the world's largest refugee camp. Grandi was speaking in Nairobi at the end of his week-long tour of Kenya and Somalia, which also included a meeting with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta.
That when I met President Kenyatta yesterday, he opened the meeting by saying emphatically that Kenya would remain faithful to its tradition of being a country of asylum to refugees fleeing conflict and hardship from many neighboring countries.
Kenya has vowed to send back 350,000 Somali refugees living in Dadaab back home, claiming the camp is a drain on national resources and a security threat. But Grandi says Kenya's time frame for putting in place structures for a safe and voluntary return for the refugees was very short. Grandi was speaking after visiting the sprawling camp.
We all know also that Dadaab is a camp where hundreds of thousands of refugees live in very difficult conditions. And over the years, and in spite of very generous support by donors, the insufficient amount of assistance has created a situation of which is not very easy.
Grandi said the planned returns would not be conducted unilaterally by Kenya, but in discussion with the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and the Somali government, and would require financial support from foreign donors to improve conditions in war-torn Somalia. The vast majority of residents of Dadaab, close to the Kenya-Somalia border, fled Somalia's more than two decades-long conflict. Many remain fearful of returning to a country where insecurity remains rife and life tough.
Ruben Kiama reporting. And up next, how a young man is helping young teenagers out of crime and violence.
Making a difference.
Let's go now to Cameroon and meet Achaleke Christian Leke. He was born in Kumba, referred to as the Baghdad of Cameroon because of the high wave of violence there. As a teenager, Achaleke was no stranger to violence. Oftentimes, he engaged in fights with the police, but all that is now history. The 26-year-old is now youth peace and security activist. He uses his personal experience to transform young people in his hometown and beyond. His work attracted international recognition and is now a youth ambassador for the Commonwealth of Nations. His experience has been shared in global events, including the Global Youth Summit Against Violent Extremism, organized with the support of the White House and the U.S. Department of State. DW's Moki Kinseka has his story.
Traders here at the Kumba Market in southwestern Cameroon still remember Achaleke Christian Leke as a stubborn teenage boy. His 25-year-old mate, Clifford Ndoki says, like many other teenagers around Kumba Market, Christian was involved in acts of violence against market officials, traders, and at times the police.
Look at that open space with two vehicles. That was our training ground for football matches. Anybody who tried to stop us was in for a severe moment. We were ready to beat him or pour dirty water on him or her and escape.
Due to his violent, aggressive, and bad behavior, Christian's parents decided the best solution for their son was to transfer him to a missionary secondary school in Boya, another town in southwestern Cameroon.
Because of the violence, my parents had to send me to another town to study in the boarding school. And when I got there, I realized that it was contrary to where I grew up. It was all about peace. It was all about reconciling with people. It was all about, you know, dialoguing. So I was so strange in there. I remember times when I tried to use violence in solving some of my situations. I was all alone. I met even some of my peers who were born in Kumba. They told me, no, we cannot do violence here. So that was where the inspiration all came from. I said, no, I need to continue with this.
The discipline and Christian education greatly influenced the way Acheleke Christian Leke interacted with people. From then on, he had this desire to stand out positively in society and impact the lives of people back in his community. Today, he is a youth ambassador to the Commonwealth of Nations and civil society leader. He preaches peace, unity, reconciliation and harmony in Cameroon, asking leaders to embrace youth emancipation and create opportunities for them as a means of stopping the violence. He says that is also another way of solving the Boko Haram terrorism crisis that has killed thousands and displaced millions in Nigeria, Chad, and Cameroon.
You know, these things are pushed because of poverty, because of unemployment, because of youth exclusion, and these challenges which makes young people to feel excluded, which makes young people to feel they're alone. And they see no other means of survival than violence. But with the current challenge which we have in the northern part of the country with terrorism and all that, we have a serious fear because this violence, we neglected them. Our government is not actually solving this basic problem. So we need to work together to see how we can solve these challenges of poverty, giving young people an alternative means of living. Apart from violence, that is what we need. And if we can give them that, I'm very sure we'll be protecting them from recruitment and also trying to see how we can change their mindset.
Nowadays, relatives and people in his community refer to Christian as a hero. His niece, Mokete Winifred, says he is an example for others to follow.
All Kumba boys now know from him that violence is not a solution to any problem. When they saw him a few years back discussing with President Obama, they asked if it can be possible for a school dropout to meet even a local government representative. Violence only takes us to prison.
That report was compiled by Moki Kinseka in Cameroon.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/AfricaLink. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter, dw.com/AfricaLink.
And before we leave you, a quick recap of the main stories. The Nigerian government says it will negotiate with rebel groups in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. And Uganda has accused opposition leaders of planning to topple the government after an attack at a police station in the northern region of Gulu. And that's all we had time for. If you have any comment, please do not hesitate to send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or you can also send us a letter to AfricaLink DW53110 Bonn, Germany. Also a text message to +491609575910. And as always, thank you for listening. Until tomorrow, my name is Abubakar Jallo, bidding you a wonderful day. Bye now.